Hello, everyone. My name is Jordan Hill, and I'm a member of the Chicago Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society, and I'm also a stakeholder at the law firm Eimer Stahl in Chicago. We're so happy to have you all here for this event. And just a reminder, if during the panel you have any questions, please use the Q&A function at the bottom of the screen, and we'll try to get those answered. So before I hand the event over to our moderator, I just wanted to take a few moments to make some remarks about the topic at hand. And ironically, I intend to keep my comments short. So I specifically recall the first time I learned about the filibuster, which was back when I was in high school. And believe it or not, I read Robert Caro's Master of the Senate for a book report. Since then, I've closely followed the Senate. And even a passing familiarity with Senate politics over the last few years has shown that numerous senators' positions on the filibuster has been like watching a tennis match, with various senators taking different positions on minority party rights, seemingly based solely on who is in the majority. Here's a quote. "If the majority chooses to end the filibuster, and if they choose to change the rules and put an end to democratic debate, then the fighting and the bitterness and the gridlock will only become worse." That was from Senator Barack Obama. However, now some are saying that the filibuster is a relic of Jim Crow and a threat to democracy. But still, the questions remain. Should we have the filibuster at all? Does historical misuse negate any use? And most importantly, what Dr. Seuss book won't be canceled so that it can be read during the next filibuster speech? Hopefully, we will get answers to some of these questions and more with our panel today. And I'm thrilled to introduce the moderator, Peter Roskam. Peter Roskam is a partner at Sidley Austin in Chicago, where he counsels his clients on matters involving law, government, media, and public policy. He served for six terms in the U.S. House of Representatives, representing the people of Illinois' 6th Congressional District. While in Congress, Congressman Roskam served as the Chief Deputy Whip and served on the House Ways and Means Committee. And before his time in the House of Representatives, Congressman Roskam served in the Illinois legislature from 1993 to 2007, representing the people of Chicago's western suburbs. And with that, Peter, take it away.
Well, thanks, Jordan, very much. And it's it's a treat to be here, and particularly to be with our two panelists. So let me introduce them. These are faces and names that are familiar to you. And so these introductions will be fairly short, but it's worth setting the table just in terms of their background. So Senator John Kyle is no stranger to anybody. He served and represented Arizona in the House of Representatives and in the U.S. Senate. Interestingly, he's held both Senate seats in the U.S. Senate, which is, I think, quite a feat. And I'm sure a trivia get out of jail free card, which not a lot of others have pulled off. And he's got, I think, a great background. His accolades are full of superlatives. And I can tell you just by reputation, he's somebody that when he would weigh in on things and come into whip meetings that I was active in and elsewhere, he had authority and a great deal of respect. And so it's a joy to have Senator Kyle with us. Martin Gold, who is our other panelist, who is someone who has served greatly in the U.S. Senate, going back to joining Senator Mark Hatfield's staff in 1972, the senator from Oregon. And he has served Senate Republican leaders closely, of counsel to them, and both for Howard Baker and Bill Frist. And today he's at Capitol Council in Washington, D.C. And he's been described as really one of the most solid experts with the deepest background on this nettlesome thing about Senate procedure in particular. And now let's just jump in to this filibuster. You know, Senator Kyle, could you just give us some observations? When you and I, when we were doing a pre-call, you know, I said you're one of the few people that that's bilingual in this sense, and that you've served in the House, you've served in the Senate. These are very, very different institutions. So in your opening remarks, can you reflect a little bit about the difference in these two institutions?
Let me mention one, and then I think Marty will do the primary preliminary discussion of the filibuster, And I'll talk a little bit more about the practical way that it actually plays out. But your first question here is really critical, because there is a huge difference between the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate. And it was intended to be that way when the Constitution was written. Among the most serious of the debates in the Constitutional Convention were those questions that focused on the differences between the people that would work in the House of Representatives and those, on the other hand, that would be in the Senate. I've served in both. In the House of Representatives, I was in a minority, and I could have been a potted plant and been just as important as I thought I was. The minority has no rights in the House of Representatives. As a matter of fact, that's not quite right. They have a right after they've lost a question to move to reconsider it, to send it back to committee. That's simply a way for them to clear their throat, basically, and complain about the fact that they just lost the vote. So the majority runs everything. The speaker has a rules committee that decides all of the conditions of debate on it, on every bill. The bill will have 1 hour of debate equally divided. There will be three amendments permitted. These are what the amendments will be. The debate will be 10 minutes each on each of the amendments, 5 minutes per side. Whatever the rule is, those are the conditions under which a matter will be debated and decided. In the Senate, on the other hand, there is no majority rule governs everything. As a matter of fact, there's a great deal of respect for the minority, and the filibuster is a part of that. So when you're in the minority in the Senate, you almost have as much rights as the people in the majority do. As a matter of fact, technically, the leader in the Senate, the majority party leader, has only one right that all of the other senators don't have, and that's the right of first recognition by the chair. Other than that, the senators are all equal. And there is no rules committee that decides how bills will come to the floor, which bills will come, how they'll come, what amendments will be permitted, and the like. That all has to be worked out. And the filibuster, as I'll talk about in a moment, is one of the key ways in which those questions all get worked out. Note what we're beginning to think about here is negotiation and compromise. We'll get there in a minute.
Okay, so Marty, can you shed, so just shed the House, that's over there. Walk us into the Senate chambers and give us a sense of what this mysterious institution is like, particularly as it relates to protecting the minority's rights.
Thank you, Peter, and thanks to all of you for this invitation. Before I start, I just want to say that if Jordan Hill read Master of the Senate for a high school book report, this is the most impressive thing I've heard. The book is 800 pages long, and every page is worth reading because Robert Caro did a masterful job with Lyndon Johnson, believe me. Four volumes so far and more to come. Anyway, look, we ought to talk in the first place about what a filibuster is. 1939, Frank Capra produced Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. It shows Jimmy Stewart on the Senate floor with a stack of telegrams in his hand, filibustering for hours until he drops on the floor. I think it's probably the most influential movie that's ever been made about the Senate and gives people an impression about the filibuster that can be true, but is largely, largely distorted. Filibuster involves the use of tactics, various tactics, all of which have the purpose of impeding, for whatever reason, the passage of legislation. Could be to block it, could be to leverage something in that legislation. It can involve extended speeches. Strom Thurmond once spoke for over 24 hours in an extended Jimmy Stewart kind of speech, but that's rare. Much more often, it can involve a long string of amendments. It can involve objection to unanimous consent agreements. That's a very common tactic. And other tactics, all of which have the effect of stopping the Senate from expediting business. Now, the Senate can choose to tolerate that or not choose to tolerate it. The filibuster really didn't start in the Senate for the first half century of its existence, but by about the early 1840s, filibusters began to emerge. And they were used with some regularity through the 19th century into the 20th century, until finally in 1917, the Senate adopted a rule that allowed for a supermajority vote to end the filibuster if a supermajority of senators of some level was ready to do that. Now, in 1917, that was two-thirds of the senators who were voting. And since then, it's been more than 100 years now, that number has varied from time to time, but it has been stable since 1975. Since 1975, the number has been a flat 60. So if the vote's 59 to nothing, you don't get cloture. But if the vote is 60 to 40, you do. And that's basically it. So if the Senate wants to move past the filibuster, the Senate can. Filibuster is a balance point. It's a fulcrum. It's the place where you balance the rights of the individual and the capacity of the institution to work its will. And sometimes you swing the pivot one way, and sometimes you swing the pivot the other way. So the notion of preserving this has become a point of great importance in the Senate. There has been in recent years pressure on the filibuster when it comes to nominations. And the filibuster is fundamentally no longer exists for nominations. But the filibuster does exist for legislation, has always existed for legislation, and at no time in the history of the Senate has the Senate ever had majority cloture for legislation. When Neil Gorsuch was confirmed to the Supreme Court in April of 2017, it was one of those moments of pressure on the filibuster where filibusters on Supreme Court nominations ended. Filibusters on all other nominations had ended by Harry Reid in 2013. Mitch McConnell closed the rest of it in 2017. At the time, there was tremendous bipartisan concern that this not happen to legislation. Senator Collins of Maine, Republican, and Senator Coons of Delaware, Democrat, prepared a letter. It was signed by 61 senators, including themselves, went to the majority leader, Mitch McConnell, and the Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer. And I want to quote from this letter for just a moment here to make a point about what these senators thought was important. They said, "We are writing to urge you to support our efforts to preserve the existing rules, practices, and traditions as they pertain to right of members to engage in extended debate on legislation before the United States Senate. Senators have expressed a variety of opinions about the appropriateness of limiting debate when we're considering judicial and executive branch nominations. Regardless of our past disagreements on that issue, we are united in our determination to preserve the ability of members to engage in extended debate when bills are on the Senate floor." And they continue, "We are mindful of the unique role the Senate plays in the legislative process, and we are steadfastly committed to ensuring that this great American institution continues to serve as the world's greatest deliberative body. Therefore, we are asking you to join us in opposing any effort to curtail the existing rights and prerogatives of senators to engage in full, robust, and extended debate as we consider legislation before this body in the future." 61 senators on that letter, 31 Republicans and 30 Democrats. Of the 31 Republicans, 21 are still sitting. Of the 30 Democrats, 25 of them are still sitting. And one of the people who is not still sitting, but who did sign that letter, was Kamala Harris. So, the bottom line, I suppose, of all of that is to say that 4 years ago, not 24 years ago or 44 years ago, 4 years ago, a significant majority of senators signed a letter saying the legislative filibuster must be preserved. What has changed since that time? One thing and one thing alone, an election. There is an issue here of where one stands depends on where one sits. But people who are very concerned about the preservation of minority rights when they were in the minority sometimes have less concern when the status changes. I want to say just one more thing here, and then we'll turn it back to Senator Kyle. That is this. Senator mentioned major differences between the Senate and the House, and this does, as he said, go back to the Constitutional Convention. James Madison, speaking in the Constitutional Convention, talked about the Senate being a legislative fence against the passions of the House, that it was necessary to have a bicameral legislature for that reason, because long before they decided there should be two senators from every state, James Madison favored doing the Senate on a proportional basis. He still thought there should be a Senate with different rules from the House, exactly to serve that function. Well, I'll tell you what, Senator Kyle is not the only one who knows this. Chuck Schumer knows this. In 2005, he made this statement on the Senate floor. It is the Senate where the founding fathers established a repository of checks and balances. It's not like the House of Representatives where the majority leader or the speaker can snap his fingers and get what he wants. The reason we don't work by majority rule is very simple, he said. On important issues, the founding fathers wanted, and they were correct in my judgment, that the slimmest majority should not always govern. The Senate is not a majoritarian body. So with that, let me turn it back to Senator Kyle.
Peter, shall I go ahead with a...
Please do, Senator.
All right. What I thought I would do is reiterate one thing that Marty said and then go through an exercise here. The filibuster is used for two purposes, either to stop legislation or to leverage position for various ways in which you can gain more control in how the legislation is considered. So let's take an actual example. The presiding officer should call first on the majority leader. And the majority leader will frequently say something like this: I now ask unanimous consent that the Senate proceed to the consideration of Senate Bill 10. That's the way that the Senate operates, by unanimous consent. Very important point. The presiding officer will then say, is there objection? Now, I'm in the minority, and so I say, Mr. President, I object. At that point, what will usually happen is that the majority leader will note the absence of a quorum. Regardless of how many people are present, he will note the absence of quorum, which is in effect a timeout, where the roll is called and he and I will have a conversation. He'll pad over to where I am or motion me over and say, why are you objecting? And I may say something like, well, I didn't know you were going to bring that bill up. We're not ready for that yet. Well, we could stipulate that we'll consider it in a week or so. Well, okay. But we're going to want amendments. Well, how many amendments? Oh, I don't know. We're probably going to want 50 amendments. 50? You've got to be kidding. We don't have time for 50 amendments. Well, maybe, you know, 35 or 40. What are we beginning to do here? He and I are beginning to negotiate, like the Rules Committee in the House is supposed to function, to develop the way in which the bill is going to come to the floor, how it's going to be considered, how many debate amendments will be allowed, what those amendments are, and all of the other features of how the legislation is going to be considered. That's my way as a member of the minority for making sure that my party's rights or my area of the country's rights, whatever minority I may represent, that our rights are protected, that we're not just going to get railroaded with this bill coming up today and passing tomorrow, and we hardly have a chance to say, wait a minute. So we finally work out terms, and after the quorum call, the majority leader is recognized again, and he says, Mr. President, I now ask again that the Senate proceed to the consideration of Senate Bill 10 under the following conditions. And then he reads the stipulation that basically our two staffs have drafted that reflect our negotiated agreement on how the legislation is going to be considered. Once he's read that, the presiding officer says, is there objection? Hearing none, we'll proceed. Okay. That's one way in which the filibuster is used to make sure that the minority's rights to have some say in how the legislation is considered are recognized. The other way, as I said, is if you've got 40 votes or 41 votes, you can stop legislation. And in 2020, the Democrats used the filibuster 327 times to stop legislation that the Republicans favored. you can do that. And the way that that can be defeated, of course, is that if you have 60 colleagues who want to proceed, you have a cloture vote. The vote is 60 to 40. We proceed with the consideration of the legislation. And the filibuster really comes into play at three different times. At the beginning, where you're deciding whether to proceed to a particular bill, during the consideration of the debate when amendments are being offered, you can filibuster any of the amendments that are offered unless there's been a unanimous consent agreement that would preclude that. And then when you're all done with the debate and amendments and you get ready to have the final vote, once again, you have to have unanimous consent to proceed to a final vote, and that would require 60 votes. So that's basically the way that it works in practice. And you can see that it fosters negotiation, it fosters compromise, and it does protect minority rights. And most importantly, it prevents legislation from passing by very slim majorities. And what almost all political scientists will acknowledge is that the greater the bipartisanship, the greater the margin that legislation passes by, the longer that legislation stays extant and the more popular that it is. If you have legislation passing 51 to 49 all the time, that legislation is going to be reconsidered as soon as the parties change their position in the Senate and you have a different majority. Much better to have a much larger consensus. That makes for longevity of policy, for more certainty. You don't have a lot of policy changes roiling about all of the time. And that was the reason why the founders thought that having a Senate that protected these minority rights and was not purely majoritarian was a beneficial thing.
May I add one thing to that? The vivid example of what the senator is talking about, the vivid example, happened just in 2020. On the first major COVID relief bill. COVID relief legislation, what could be more important at the time it was passed, right? The Republicans came up with a package. Of course, the Democrats can't filibuster the COVID relief bill, can they? Because there's emergency conditions in the country, but surely they can. They twice blocked the motion to proceed to the bill. And why did they do it? Because they didn't want people to get relief? Absolutely not. It's because they had their own priorities they wanted to put in the bill. And when they showed twice that they had the capacity to block the legislation until their priorities were also considered, negotiations reopened, the legislation was modified, and then it passed unanimously, actually, on a roll call vote, 96 to nothing. So the point is, the filibuster was used, sometimes it is used to block legislation, but it is also used for the purpose of leveraging legislation and developing bipartisan consensus, just as the senator said. And the example of it that could not be more vivid is what happened on coronavirus relief legislation, the first time they took a major COVID bill through.
Marty, let me press in on that. And before I do, let me just invite people, if you have a question for the panelists, go to the Q&A function down at the bottom of your screen. And if your questions are make our panelists look good, we'll get to them. No, I'm teasing. We'll get to as many questions as we can. So, Marty, let me press in on that. You know, the senator made a point a minute ago about, look, and it's pretty intuitive, a bipartisan approach is better. It's more stable. And I'll agree to that. But what we see now is amount of political power that is being moved through the administration and the rulemaking process and the use of executive orders to do an end run around the filibuster. And so in that point of view, the vote seems unstable. You know, we had Obama era rules that were promulgated because, you know, he famously said, I have a pen and a phone, because he was frustrated by the filibuster. Donald Trump comes into office, reverses a number of those. Joe Biden comes into office, goes back, and you take my point. So this inability, or, you know, put it in the least favorable light, you know, the ability of a minority to be passive aggressive, there's some elements of American public life that are destabilized by that. What do you think of that assertion?
Well, I think that bypassing the legislative process unnecessarily I shouldn't use the word unnecessarily, bypassing legislative process through executive orders or things that should normally be taken up through legislation and would be better if they were taken up by legislation is of course problematic. I will note this, Obama's frustration was not a frustration with the filibuster. Obama's frustration was that he had a Republican majority in the Senate and he didn't get legislation through because he didn't have votes. And he wouldn't have had the vote. I mean, he just didn't have the votes. So it wasn't that people were filibustering him, is that he couldn't achieve bipartisan agreements. And that is just the nature of checks and balances, it seems to me. Now, presidents want to work around that, and sometimes they can work around it, but they do work around it, as you note, Peter, in an unstable way. Because when something is not done by legislation and something is done by executive order, then it can easily be undone. Very, very much, for example, like Obama bypassing the Senate for the Iran nuclear sanctions agreement, okay, because he didn't want to submit it as a treaty. And so he had an executive agreement that Trump undid with another executive agreement. So when you bypass the Senate or the Congress as a matter of convenience, you do run that risk. Maybe presidents don't have a choice in some instance. Maybe they have to take action in some instance, but it does create the problem of destabilization when you get a president of another party coming in who can easily undo what you did by the same mechanism you did it.
Peter, Section 1 of the Constitution begins with something like of the phrase that all legislative power is vested in the Congress. That's where the legislative policy is supposed to be made, not by executive order of presidents.
Yeah, that's right. What do you think of the general notion that, you know, we are really an instant gratification culture, and we all fall into this, and I'm not being sanctimonious. I am too. We all want what we want when we want it. We have an assumption that we can click on an airline app and get a flight and an e-ticket and a boarding pass to us with the twinkling of an eye. And if I get 15 seconds of that thing reloading, that little spinning thing, I'm like, you know what, loser made this thing. This thing's junk. Okay, it's ridiculous. The speed with which we expect things to be done. What do we do with that right now? I spent a lot of time traveling interacting with other parliamentarians around the world in emerging democracies. And even though we had translators between us, we were practically finishing each other's sentences. Why? Because we all represented the constituencies with a very high expectation of the ease with which things are supposed to go. In other words, and Senator, you heard this all the time, I'm sure, was from some folks in Arizona. Hey, you've got majorities there. What else do you want? Get it done. And I don't want to hear your excuses. Talk to the hand. I don't want to hear your procedural nonsense and hijinks. Get it done. How do we speak into that frustration? Because I'm telling you, on the ground, that was real.
Indeed, and I'll add one more feature to it. As history has progressed here and things have gotten much quicker, the pace at which we should be making decisions has increased. One of the results of that has been the increase in presidential power, because it's much easier for a president of one party to act than it is for 535 legislators of two different parties and two different bodies to act. And so there's no question that modern exigencies put a lot of pressure on very quick decisions and decisions that can be made by the executive, by one person. I would argue, nevertheless, that careful, thoughtful consideration is still a value to be preserved. That secondly, many times doing nothing is at least as good, if not better, than quickly doing something, because we've all seen some emergency develop and we want to jump to a solution. I've seen many solutions to problems that were later that were done quickly that were later shown to be very, very foolish. So this is something that we should grapple with, but I'll conclude by saying, I think our problem could probably be resolved if we worked on a different problem than the filibuster. And that is something else that the founding fathers thought was essential to the proper functioning of our democratic republic. And that was that the public servants exercised civic virtue. Our problem today, in my view, is that we've pretty much passed on that. Everything is put in partisan. You win, we lose, zero-sum game terms. And there's a lot that could be resolved if we simply had the willingness to recognize that the world doesn't come to an end if we have to do a little compromising, and we should exercise that civic virtue that the founders assumed would be a part of our governing 200 years later.
Marty, what do you think about that instant gratification dilemma?
I think the instant gratification dilemma results in policies that are not well thought out, not well researched, not well considered, not well debated, not well compromised, not well thought out. Since I was in the business before of quoting Democrats, I'm going to quote one more, Harry Reid. Okay, he made a point that directly relates to what you're asking about. He said, the right to extended debate is never more important than when one party controls Congress and the White House. He says, in these cases, the filibuster serves as a check on power and preserves our limited government. In other words, you don't want a complete fast track. You want deliberate consideration. You want the public to get educated on issues, and you want issues to be fully vetted. If you have one party government that you basically set up by basically breaking rules to change rules, right? And then you develop one party government, you will get much more of that instant gratification you're talking about. All you then have to have is party discipline. And all you have to do is talk to yourself in an echo chamber. But that doesn't really make for good policy. Not only does it make for unstable policy, it also makes for unwise policy, I would judge, in many instances. And it is very well to have the views of others built into legislation, not only for stability, but also for difference of perspectives. So you have to take time to do things. It runs exactly contrary to this culture of instant gratification. But I think I will say Harry Reid is right about that. It is never more important to have these rules than when you have absolute control in the trifecta, where one party controls both houses and the White House.
Marty, earlier in your opening remarks, you were commenting and you were making the distinction between the filibuster as it relates to nominations and the filibuster as it relates to legislation. So the contrarian in me says, well, look, the filibuster was abolished basically for nominations, and the sun came up, and we got some good justices as a result. I think most folks on this call would say, you know, Gorsuch and Kavanaugh and Coney Barrett are complete all-stars who might not likely be there but for the abolition of the filibuster. What's your view on that, sort of the level of negotiation that Senator Kyle was speaking to a little bit earlier, and that is that floor exercise that he walked through? And is there does the reassertion of the filibuster as it relates to nominations, is that would that ever be in play and under consideration? And similarly, would it make for a more sort of stable or highly esteemed court in the eyes of the public? What do you think of that?
Well, I'll tell you this. I mentioned that filibusters on legislation dated back to the 1840s. Okay. Filibusters on nominations did not exist fundamentally until 2003. Okay. There was one judge in the history of the United States prior to 2003 who was blocked on a filibuster. And that was Abe Fortas, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in 1968, and the filibuster was bipartisan. And I don't mean one or two stragglers, I mean meaningfully bipartisan. In 2003, the Democrats began to filibuster George W. Bush appellate appointments And in that Congress, they blocked 10 nominees directly on filibuster and had essentially negative influences on the potential nominations of six more people. So it was a wholesale change. They didn't change the rules whatsoever when they did that. They changed the practice. They used rules that could have been used by any minority in Senate history, but which were not used, and reapplied them to block those nominees. I remember their argument at the time they did it. They said that the filibuster served to moderate the nominations of people coming to the bench. In other words, you wouldn't have people from the extreme right or the extreme left if you had the filibuster, because while you can't negotiate nominations the same way you negotiate legislation, for example, right? We want so many amendments. You can't amend nominations. It's a different circumstance. Still, the question is the nominee so far out of the mainstream, to use a famous phrase, that they just can't get the kind of consensus that would allow them to get through? And their point was, I don't believe, by the way, that the people they were blocking were out of the mainstream, but they thought they were, that the way to moderate judicial appointments was to use the filibuster to block extreme appointments. And that could be used to block people extreme on the right, and it could be used to block people extreme on the left. Ironically, they are the same people that took those rights away when they used the nuclear option in 2013 to end the filibuster for all appointments, executive and judicial branch, other than for the Supreme Court of the United States. So that means that essentially the argument they thought was so persuasive, that it is, it moderated who was going to go on the bench, seemed to be unimportant when it was their people being blocked, which was the case in 2013 with Obama. Now, you ask whether or not this can ever come back. I don't think so. When McConnell came into the leadership in 2015, there were people who thought that, who opposed what was done by Reid in 2013 and thought McConnell should restore the old rules. But now you're in this situation. Well, the changed rules were used to confirm a lot of Democrats to the bench. Why are we going to let them block our nominees to the bench? Right? So it didn't happen. Then when Gorsuch came up, there was the possibility of a filibuster on Gorsuch, which was in fact conducted. The point there was, well, if we don't change the rules to put Gorsuch on the bench, they've already proven they will change the rules the next time they have a majority. So in essence, once you break Humpty Dumpty here, it is very, very difficult to put Humpty Dumpty back together. But I will say one last thing here. As I mentioned, the Senate has traditionally treated nominations very differently from legislation. When the Democrats began to filibuster those Bush appellate appointments in 2003, they did not break rules. They broke traditions. And what it could be said had happened between the 2013 nuclear option and the 2017 nuclear option was a restoration of status quo ante. Basically, what existed in terms of how you treated nominations before this departure in 2003. Again, legislation has never been treated like that. So I don't think that you have to apply the same rules to both situations.
Could I just add one other thing to that? I spoke about the concept of civic virtue before and tradition. When Clarence Thomas's nomination for the Supreme Court came before the full Senate, it was very clear that almost, if not all, Democrats opposed his nomination. Two of the Democrats who spoke on the floor were Ted Kennedy and Patrick Leahy, both members of the Judiciary Committee. Leahy later became chairman. Both of them made speeches in which they said essentially this: we have the right to filibuster this nomination, and we could do so, but it's never been done before. We're not about to start it. It wouldn't be right. And so even though we could defeat this man who we do not want to sit on the Supreme Court, we're not going to exercise that right of filibuster. Now, that was an exercise in civic virtue, people not using power that they could have used, but for the good of the institution, for the good of the government, for the good of society, they thought that preserving the tradition was more important, and therefore they backed away and didn't do it. And I commend them both for the decision that they made to enable Clarence Thomas to sit on the Supreme Court.
Well, let's go to a question. One of the questions here is there really gridlock in Congress, or is the system still working? Eliminating the filibuster seems to be suggested as a way to end gridlock. What do you think of that?
Well, you just had in early June the passage of the Innovation and Competition Act in the Senate, which was the work product of about five Senate committees. We can call it China-inspired legislation, right? It wasn't entirely China as the subject, but let's say this, without the competition and some would say threat of China, you would not have gotten that bill. The bill would never have been created. There was broad bipartisan consensus. It came out of committee with very few dissenting votes in the Commerce Committee. Other committee work products were added, and it passed on the floor with a very, very significant vote. It was consensus legislation. Today, there's an announcement about an infrastructure agreement between a bipartisan group of senators and the White House. Now, some people are unhappy about that, and they want to expand upon that. They want to have a reconciliation bill to take up what the infrastructure agreement won't do. But in any case, I don't think that either the Innovation and Competition Act, which passes in early June, or the infrastructure agreement, which has arrived at in late June, demonstrates gridlock. I just don't think so. There are going to be legitimate areas of disagreement, but at the end of the day, the debt ceiling is going to pass. Appropriations bills are going to pass. The government is going to continue to be funded. Major policy areas are also going to achieve bipartisan agreement. And when there is serious disagreement, as there was with S1 and this voting legislation the Democrats brought, then the filibuster will be used to block it. So much, by the way, as the Democrats used the filibuster in the last Congress to block policing reform legislation, where there was not agreement, right? And in this Congress, policing reform legislation is being negotiated, and there might be agreement, and that will pass also. So at the end of the day, it's very easy for people to look at their own priorities and say, my God, but for the filibuster, that would have gotten through. It ignores the fact that serious work can get done in terms of getting consensus and on major issues. And I would argue that infrastructure and innovation and competition are major issues. A bipartisan agreement is not only possible, but is achieved.
One other answer to the question is that the American people, in their wisdom, elected a Senate that's 50-50. That's a recipe for gridlock. You know, neither side has a big mandate for getting a whole lot of very partisan things done right now. It doesn't exist. That's the result of a vote of the people.
Let's go to another question, and I'll invite others. Go to the Q&A function and type in your question, and we welcome them. So here's a question. Do you think the newer phenomena of 24/7 media coverage and outrage on Twitter and social media actually applies added pressure to senators, despite these forces not understanding the intricacies of the filibuster as a procedural protection, or do members and their staff recognize that only a vocal minority supports getting rid of the filibuster? Senator, what do you think?
I'm not sure I understand the question, but if the fundamental part of it is the 24/7 news cycle and talk radio and cable TV and the rest, does it contribute to the lesser ability of the senators to come together on things? The answer, I think, is organized groups outside party and House members both, and basically say we're going to want it. That's political pressure. It's always existed and it always will.
What do you think, Marty, about that notion of a minority trying to gin up the rest of the country on Twitter and Facebook and so forth to abolish the filibuster? What's your sense of that?
Well, I think there are very committed activists who are able to generate a fair amount of support within a party to do exactly that. In other words, it's the squeaky wheel syndrome, right? The people most committed on the issue are the ones who are most likely to be heard. I am 100% certain of something. There is not an ounce of principle in this, not an ounce. If one of the Senate elections in Georgia had been opposite in January, those loud voices would be absolutely silent. And if the presidential election had been opposite in November, those loud voices would be demanding more filibusters. Mm-hmm. I'm very sure of that.
Can you walk through, so going back to your opening remarks, Marty, where you were defining the filibuster, that was interesting to me in particular. In other words, I've got to admit, I'm one of those people that was kind of a Mr. Smith goes to Washington guy. You know, it's like it's such a powerful image. But what you're describing is essentially one procedural restraint after another, and that the cumulative nature of that all combines to a filibuster. Is that right? I mean, those are all described as filibuster techniques.
Well, they are techniques, and they're not necessarily all used in the same situation. You could object to a consent agreement. You don't have to say a word, right? Or you could stand on the floor and make a long speech, and there's no consent agreement. I've often talked about Strom Thurmond's filibuster, 24 hours and 18 minutes straight, can you imagine? Mm-hmm. And he was 55 years old when he did it, and he lived to be 100. So only proved that... You just need some stamina, that's all. It doesn't damage your health. I think different situations require different tactics. It's just a playbook of tactics, right, that can be used. And by the way, and they can shift, right? First they object to a consent agreement, then later on they want more amendments. I mean, there's example after example after example of legislation where filibusters don't necessarily happen at the beginning, but midstream they occur. You know, there was major education legislation that passed in 2015 called the Every Student Succeeds Act, which were amendments to No Child Left Behind. It came out of a committee on a bipartisan basis out of the Senate Health Committee with Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray. It came to the floor by unanimous consent, which nowadays is pretty rare for major bills, but it did. It came to the floor by unanimous consent. And then it was going on, and they had had 34 amendments that had been taken up on the floor. So finally, McConnell decided that it was time for cloture, and he put down a cloture motion on that bill. And the cloture motion takes 2 days from the time you file it to the time you vote on it, right? In the middle day, there was a colloquy on the floor, a colloquy between Senator Alexander, who was the bill manager on the Republican side, and Senator Reid, who was the minority leader. And Reid basically tells Alexander, we need more amendments. We've had 34 amendments. We need more amendments. He said, and until we get them, you're not getting cloture. His words were, until my senators are protected in what sense? They want more amendments. And until we get them, you're not getting cloture. Alexander says, well, we sort of know what to do. We're going to go back and talk to Murray. The next morning, he makes an announcement. We have an agreement for more amendments, 42 more amendments, 21 in a manager's amendment and 21 separately considered on the floor. And with 42 or more amendments, now the beast has been fed. And they got cloture with more than 90 votes. So, you know, the bill was not controversial in the first place out of committee. It was not controversial when it came to the floor, and it was not controversial at the end. But in the middle, when they were trying to leverage more amendments, it became controversial, and then there was a way. There was a way of getting rid of the controversy, which was feed the beast.
Peter, if I could just add to describe another phenomenon here, which helps, I think, elucidate what's really going on. If you have a large consensus for legislation, it's eventually going to pass. If you've got 60 votes out there, the minority is not going to be able to stop it from passing. A lot of the complaint has to do with a handful, four or five senators, or maybe just one, objecting. And the solution to that is to divert from the tradition which has developed, which is that if we know that a senator is going to object to a unanimous consent request to move forward in some way, we acknowledge that objection and we respect it. And we don't continually make the request and require him to stay on the floor and object every time. We just assume that we want to respect his objection and try to work it out somehow. But at any time that the presiding officer wants to, once that objecting senator leaves the floor, the presiding officer can again put the question to the body. Is there objection to proceeding with whatever? And if the objecting senator isn't there, there's no objection and they proceed. So a lot of this has developed as a matter of comity, respecting each senator's right to object, bring forth a question that needs to be resolved or negotiated anyway. It avoids the problem of the senator having to stand up and talk for 24 hours in order to hold the floor. But I can tell you that I was part of a situation in which a Republican senator objected to a very important bill. Nobody liked it. He got on an airplane and went home for the weekend. The rest of us talked it over and agreed that if the presiding officer wanted to put the question to the body again, we didn't know of anybody that would object. And I was whip at the time, and one of my jobs was to make objections for others who, for one reason or another, couldn't be there. And I called the senator and said, I will not be making the objection for you. If you want to make it, you've got to get on the airplane and get back here. We won't do it till noon or whatever, so you've got plenty of time. He didn't come back. Presiding officer put the question to the body. There was no objection heard, and we went on. So if there's one or two recalcitrant people who are creating problems, gridlock for no good reason, you can get over that pretty easily, unless you've got a whole bunch of them who are willing to take turns keeping the floor. And at that point, then you're into this question of, do you really want to do this with a very slim majority, or do you need to have more of a consensus?
Brilliant. I love that. Here's a question on budget reconciliation, which I think is something that I'm glad was brought to my attention. So here's the question. The budget reconciliation process can apparently be used to revise significant content. As such, is the filibuster less meaningful with regard to spending bills and policy amendments? If so, or if not, are there other meaningful measures that can reduce merited public cynicism about the legislative process? Marty, what do you think? That budget reconciliation seems like a little bit of a hustle to me. And we used it, you know, I was very active in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and we were, good grief, the nonsense we went through to fit things through budget reconciliation. It made hot yoga look like nothing compared to that. So what do you think, Marty? how do we justify this reconciliation process?
Well, look, I mean, nothing in this world is absolute. And the right to filibuster is not absolute, because cloture is a check on it, right? And one of the other checks on it is expedited procedure laws like budget reconciliation. There's a bunch of expedited procedure laws, but there are about 25 or so of them on the books for all kinds of topics, but none of them is as significant as the Budget Act. And none of them is as impactful as budget reconciliation. Budget reconciliation can be used to pass by simple majority vote, a non-filibusterable vehicle, right? Can't filibuster the motion to proceed to a reconciliation bill, and you can't filibuster the bill itself. But because it is so impactful on senators' ability to debate and senators' ability to amend both, okay, there are guardrails around what can be put into a reconciliation bill. The term for it is the Byrd Rule. But basically, it's named after Robert C. Byrd, longest serving senator ever. But it's a series of guardrails that essentially narrow what can be put into a reconciliation bill. And to summarize what can be complicated pretty simply, what goes into that bill has got to be impactful on the federal budget, and it's got to be primarily impactful on the federal budget. In other words, you can't put provisions in there that are just policy provisions that don't have federal budget impact, either on revenue or on spending. And you can't put things in there where the federal budget impact is only incidental to the provision. You cannot have a fiscal tail wagging a non-fiscal dog. So it's got to be the opposite. It's got to be a provision that is primarily, if not wholly, impactful on the federal treasury, and the rest of the policy implications elsewhere in this world are incidental. That's what can go into a reconciliation bill. So most certainly, if you got issues that will fit into such a bill, then you have filibuster workarounds. And one of those, of course, passed earlier this year, a very significant bill that Bernie Sanders moved through the floor, through the budget committee in the first place, and then through the floor. And they're talking about doing it again, certainly on additional infrastructure and other social improvements. We might find infrastructure very broadly. So there is always a tension with ever in the majority, Republican or Democrat, wants to use the convenience. Because here again, it's not a matter of principle. Who's ever in the majority wants to use the convenience of the reconciliation process to move things through that might otherwise draw an objection. And who's ever in the minority is opposed to it. The first reconciliation bills that passed in the early 1980s were pretty much bipartisan vehicles, but that was a long time ago. And for the last several decades, reconciliation bills pass almost exclusively, if not exclusively, on a partisan basis, because the minority never likes it in the sense that a vehicle is being taken up where their rights are reduced. So there is a tension between that reconciliation process and normal Senate rights, a tension that is mitigated by the Byrd rule, but not eliminated by the Byrd rule.
Senator, what do you think about reconciliation? You've seen it come and go. It's been helpful. It's been aggravating. What's your sense of it in this context?
I think Marty has summarized it exactly correctly. It will be used by the majority as much as possible to stuff stuff in. The minority will object, and there are lots of points of order that will lie. And if you have an honest parliamentarian, as Marty said, those guardrails can hold to keep it to the point of reconciliation. This is the only other major way that, other than cloture, that a mere majority can get its way. Otherwise, there are rights of the minority in the Senate that can be brought to bear, usually a simple objection to a request for unanimous consent that will give the minority some rights.
Well, everybody, look at your watches, because we're going to land right on time. So you can count, you can rest assured that when the Chicago chapter of the Federal Society invites you to a Zoom meeting, we'll be in and out, and we'll start on time and we'll end on time. And the reason that we were able to do that was because we had two great panelists. And I want to tell you both that I thought I knew, you know, quite a bit about the filibuster coming in, and I learned new things, and I've gained more insight and more perspective, and I'm going to sound great at 4th of July parties, and I'm going to be quoting you and ripping off all of your stuff. So for that, I am grateful. And just to close, Senator, you served with my predecessor, the late, great Henry Hyde. And Henry had a great line that I've used with some frequency. And he said, there's actually one thing worse than gridlock. And the worst thing is the greased chute of government. And I think that the notion of having some restraint here, there's a big percentage on it. But thank you both for your insight. It's been really, really helpful. And we all look forward to our paths crossing again soon. So thanks, everybody. Have a good day.
Bye-bye. Thank you very much. Thank you all.